7 years after Tricia Boccaccio was murdered on her family's back doorstep, Cook County Sheriff's Office assigned a new investigation team to look into what was now being treated as a cold case. Detectives submitted the physical evidence for the murder, including Tricia's fingernail clippings, for DNA testing at the Illinois State Police Crime Lab, hoping newer scientific methods would lead to a break in the case. But it took 2 more years before the investigation would narrow down potential suspects. Meanwhile, Michael Gargiulo was now living in Los Angeles, California. He had followed his brother Kenny there, trying to find work as an actor and eventually landing a job as a bouncer at the Rainbow Bar and Grill on Sunset Boulevard. In 1999, he was fired for allegedly hitting a patron, and by 2001, he was living in Hollywood, California with his Chicago-area girlfriend, Allison, at the Almer Apartments on Orchid Avenue. Just a few blocks away, a blonde 22-year-old named Ashley Ellerin lived in a bungalow on Pinehurst Road, walking distance from the Kodak Theater and the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Ashley was living an envious Hollywood lifestyle. She was enrolled in Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising and was frequently attending parties and clubs around LA. She was linked to actors like Vince Vaughn, Vin Diesel, and Jeremy Sisto. Let's bring in Tom Small, a retired homicide detective with the Los Angeles Police Department. Thank you, Tom, for joining us. Tom, tell us a bit about Ashley as a person.
I'll go right back to where she came from. She was born in Silver Spring, Maryland. She was born, I think, in July of 1978 and grew up through her adolescent years there. And then as a young lady, I think just before high school, the family moved up to Los Altos, California, which is in the Bay Area, just south of San Francisco. And she grew up there. Played water polo. She was quite an athlete from what I've been told, talking to her parents and that. She had some potential options of going on to major college in the water polo, but she opted instead. She had this thing about wanting to get to the big city. So in September, I think it was, in 2000, she moved down to L.A., and rented a Hollywood bungalow, I call it, just a one-story home, a two-bedroom, two-bath home in Hollywood. And she had a couple of roommates there. The first one, a guy by the name of Justin Peterson, they were like best friends. And he at some point moved out, I think about a month or month and a half prior to February 2001. And she had another female roommate that moved in there. While she was living in Los Angeles, she did go to FITM. FITM is a fashion school. I think it stands for Fashion Institute and Design and Merchandising, I think is what it all means. But it's downtown on Grand Avenue, I believe it is. And she attended there, but she didn't finish because she had other, I guess, things in mind. She was considering modeling and possibly breaking in, as a lot of young people do when they come to Hollywood. They want to become somebody in show business, entertainment industry. And she'd been in circles with a lot of people that are in show business. And I know you know about Ashton Kutcher. She was dating a guy that was a very close friend of Ashton. And that's how she met him.
On February 21, 2001, Ashley's father, Michael, had been staying with her for the past week, helping her move some of her belongings and painting the house. She dropped her father off at LAX Airport around 5 p.m. When she got home, Mark Durbin, the landlord, stopped by around 7 p.m. to fix the ceiling fan. The two had a relationship, despite Durbin having a girlfriend at the time. According to Durbin, they made love to each other around 7:15 p.m. Durbin said Ashley tried to get him to stay, but he left the apartment around 8:15, knowing his girlfriend would be getting home. Around 10 p.m., Ashley's roommate, Jennifer, came home and tried to come inside. She forgot her keys in her boyfriend's car, but noticed Ashley's car was parked in the driveway and the lights were still on, so she knocked on the door. When no one answered, she thought nothing of it and spent the night at her boyfriend's. According to Ashton Kutcher, he and Ashley spoke at 8:24 p.m. that night to confirm their plans. Then Ashton called her at 10 p.m. to say he was on his way to pick her up, but she didn't answer. So Ashton drove over to the house at 10:45 p.m. He knocked on the door, but no one answered. After peering through the front window, Ashton noticed a red stain on the carpet. He assumed it was red wine. He had just attended a housewarming party there weeks prior and thought it was normal for the house to be messy. Ashton thought he was being stood up for being late, so he left. The next morning, Jennifer returned home with the keys and found Ashley lying across two stairs near her bathroom, covered in blood. She originally thought Ashley was playing a joke, but when Jennifer went over and touched her body, Ashley was cold and blue. Jennifer ran out of the house and called 911 from her car. LAPD arrived on the scene and began investigating. Homicide Detective Tom Small was assigned to the case. Tom, what can you tell us about the night Ashley was murdered?
The night of her death, which was February 21st, 2001, she was getting ready at the time that she was killed. We speculate because she had just gotten out of the shower and getting ready. We saw like her hair dryer and her curling iron and all that stuff was in plain view, still plugged in and hot. So at any rate, there were a couple of calls to her while she was getting ready. I think one or two she didn't answer. One, at least, probably she was in the shower, but she got the message. She returned the call to Ashton Kutcher. That call was made at 8:24 in the evening, and we speculate that she was probably dead within 5 minutes of that call. So that's how that transpired. There's another little interesting caveat to that, in that her landlord was a guy named Mark Durbin. And Mark took care of the rent and all the maintenance of the bungalow that Ashley rented, as well as the apartment building that he actually lived in, which was kind of catty corner and across the street from the bungalow. And so he managed that apartment building as well. And they had developed over time a friendship. And, you know, Ashley had a tendency to be a little free with her affections. And Mark at the time was seeing a lady. I don't think they were engaged at the time, but they were getting close to that. But he fell off the tracks, so to speak. And he and Ashley had a little relationship prior to her going out. So they did have a little interlude, if you might put it that way, I guess. But then he was, Mark was a little nervous, so he had to leave because he had to get home before his girlfriend got home, and he was trying to beat the clock, so he left Ashley around 8:15 that evening. Shortly after that was the phone call that she made back to Ashton Kutcher to make final arrangements for their date. And then we have reason to believe that she was killed sometime before 8:30. That came about because an actual friend of Mark Durbin, who lived in the apartment building that Mark did, in fact, he lived right across the hall from Mark Durbin, he got home from work at around 8:30, maybe, or excuse me, no, I think it was 8:15, and he had to take his dog out to the dog park to let him walk around and do his business. Dog park was directly across the street from Ashley's house. And he recalls arriving at the dog park at about between 8:25 and 8:30. He saw nobody on the street. Ashley's house was all lit up. Of course, in February, it's dark outside, so the whole house was lit up. Her car was out in front. And this witness, his name is Jackson, heard two female screams that were they were separated by a few seconds. And it was so unnerving to him that it sent chills down his spine, and his dog alerted on Ashley's house, which was only 40 feet away. And the dog wouldn't come off it. And when the second scream was heard, the same thing, that dog just wouldn't budge. And Jackson had to physically pull him away and get him in the dog park so he could finish his business. And then they both got out of there. They went back to their apartment, and they arrived back at his apartment building probably somewhere around 8:35 or 8:40. So we speculate that the time that those screams happened, which was somewhere 8:25 to 8:30, was the time that Ashley was actually being murdered. So that's how we arrive at that timeline.
Was there anything about the scene that stood out as potential evidence?
I was at the station, and I was working with another detective by the name of Mike Pelletier. And we received a phone call from the field from an officer out there, a senior lead officer, very senior guy. And he says, we've got a 187 out here at 1911 Pinehurst. So that was about 9:15 in the morning of February 22nd. And as it turns out, actually the phone call to us came in a little bit later than that. It was 9:15 when Ashley's body was discovered by her female roommate. Mike Pelletier and I immediately went over there, and you know, by that time it was light. We observed that the house is located on a street that's it's a north-south street that has a dead end. There's a large parking lot to the south of the house, which is gated. The house itself is the perimeter of the house is the periphery is like wrought iron fencing, but you can see through it. And there were certain foliage and stuff in front. The house was like Fort Knox. It was a wood shingled house, and every single window in the place was barred. So it had metal bars, and the doors were made out of steel security kind of configuration. And Ashley had been doing some work in there, so it was all freshly painted, the woodworking, the doors, the door frame. So there was no evidence at all of any forced entry, no tool marks, nothing like that. So we're trying to figure out, did she let somebody in, or was the door unlocked, or how did that work, you know? And then we got further into the house, and it was still under renovation, so it was a mess. She had ladders and paint and boxes and all kinds of crap in there, so you kind of had to walk through a narrow passageway, and the area that you had to walk on was hardwood flooring. We noticed that there was a series of directional blood drops on the floor, and they all seemed to be going in a similar direction, and that was toward the exit. So we speculated that that could have been, or probably was, from the suspect. Also, these blood drops were adjacent to bloody shoe prints, but they were mostly partial. So we could get a, later on, we were able to determine a make or model of shoe. And at that time, we believed it came back as an Adidas shoe, but there are apparently some similar styles that are similar to Adidas, but this was pretty distinct. We located Ashley's body on a very short hallway. So when you enter the house, you enter on an angle and you turn left, and you go left, and there's four steps on that comes to a carpeted landing. And that landing is the hallway that connects the two bedrooms on either end of it and the bathroom that Ashley used in the middle between the two bedrooms. And she was, you know, she was clothed. She wore a terry cloth robe, which was rumpled and up over her waist. And underneath, she had what looked like a camisole or maybe some sleepwear, comfort-type clothing. Like, I guess if she was getting ready to go, she wasn't dressed yet for the party. But she had been horrifically stabbed. And looking at the way she was laid out, there was blood spatter up and down the walls, on the doors, on the door frame. The carpeting was a Berber-style carpet. It was blood-soaked. And there was a shoe impression leading down the step, the bottom step before the hardwood floor. You could tell it was a shoe, but you couldn't get what the tread pattern was until you could see it on the hardwood floor. But it appears to be similar in size to what we saw on the floor. But Ashley was, even though she was dressed, she was stabbed front, back, legs. She had a number of defensive wounds on her fingers and hand, her forearm, her thigh, her back of her head. Most of the actual deepest stab wounds are in her back, but she was also stabbed in the front. So obviously she had been rolled over, and there was some evidence on the carpeting, the way the blood pattern was, that she had been moved. And there was other evidence that seemed to indicate that she may have been posed. So that was a signature of something that, you know, we had something a little more than the normal homicide that you would run into like that. So that seemed like it was a very purposeful killing. There was no evidence of a sexual assault. We had all those avenues checked by the coroner and the coroner's criminalist. So we were able to determine that there was no even attempt at that. It seemed like the whole purpose of this was to kill her and inflict as much damage and pain as possible. And the real coup de grace was when we found her, she was on her back and her head was turned to the left, looking toward her left shoulder. And she had a really nasty, gaping neck wound. And it was so bad. I mean, you could see things in there that you ordinarily wouldn't see. And it was pretty bad. As it turns out, it was almost a decapitation. The only thing really holding her together was the skin that was remaining on her neck. So that's an indelible thing in my mind. I'll never get over what I saw there. And I've seen a lot of murders, but this one was something else. This is one of the more grisly, vicious killings that I'd ever seen.
It sounds like a horrible, horrible way to die. There were puncture wounds up to 6 inches deep. A piece of her skull was punctured by one of the blows. According to the coroner, 12 of the wounds were considered fatal on their own. From there, LAPD then began looking into possible suspects. Ashton Kutcher was at the house hours after Ashley was last seen alive by her landlord. According to Ashton, when he heard about Ashley's death, he immediately contacted the authorities because his fingerprints were all over the door and he was freaking out. Tom, who were the initial suspects as you began to work through the investigation?
Well, Hollywood at that time was... We had, especially in that particular district, it was off Highland Avenue, just west of Highland and just above Hollywood Boulevard. So we had a number of cases in the near number of months or a year involving hot prowl burglaries, robberies, loitering, trespassing, a couple of murders, some rapes. So I initially looked at all past circumstances and reports of those types of incidents and got the ball rolling on potentials there. We also looked up potential parolees that are in the area. Maybe they gave a location, or maybe they had the ankle monitors or something like that. So we looked at all that stuff. And there were a few names that stuck out that we looked at, but we couldn't tie them in at the time frame of this murder. And of course, in talking to Ashley's friends, Ashley was quite, she was a party girl. I mean, she got involved in the Hollywood scene pretty extensively. And she had a lot of friends. She had a lot of parties. In fact, some of her parties would have as many as 60 people coming in and out of that place. And so we talked to just about everybody that was still in the area that could know kind of what her associations were and friendships. And one that stuck out immediately was a friend of hers by the name of Chris Duran. And he and Ashley happened to be fixing a flat tire that Ashley had on her car. And at that time, it was daylight hours, midday, and a guy came out of the dog park from across the street, and he walked up to them, and he said, "Can I help you?" But he never helped. He didn't do anything. He got laser-focused on Ashley, and he introduced himself only as Mike. And they had never seen him before. They didn't know him, but they engaged in small talk. And so Chris Duran thought it was weird that the guy asked if he could help, but he didn't lift a finger to help. He was only focused on Ashley. And, you know, I guess it's understandable in a sense because Ashley was a very attractive young lady, so she would garner attention. But he was kind of they described him as kind of a braggadocious, you know, boastful kind of guy. He said he worked in the heating and air. He was a he fixed it. He repaired, you know, heating systems and whatnot. And then the conversation kind of ended. He walked away, and they didn't really pay attention to where he went, and they got no further on him. And a few other people recalled Ashley and Chris talking about, yeah, we met this furnace guy. But the only name that ever came up was Mike. Mark Durbin actually met him, being that he's the landlord over there. Ashley apparently asked for him, Mike, to come over and check out her furnace, which was down in the basement. It's an unfinished basement. As a matter of fact, it's a dirt floor, but there is a basement in that house. And Mark Durbin happened to come over and stand by. And Mike came over. He went down there. He looked at it, but he didn't do anything. He never fixed anything. He just kind of made his appearance. And then when Ashley would throw some of these parties, all of a sudden this Mike guy starts showing up. He was never invited. He wasn't in the circle of friends. He kind of freaked out several of Ashley's friends, and they asked her about, who is this guy? You know, what's he doing here? And she said, I don't pay any attention to him. He's a furnace guy. He just comes around for some reason. And anyways, that was a first red flag on this Mike guy, but I was trying to determine who in the hell he was and get some more lowdown. And of course, we also had to include Mark Durbin and, to an extent, Ashton Kutcher, although we ruled him out pretty quickly based on the phone call and the phone records and stuff. So he was never a real bona fide suspect. And he was nervous about it because he said, yeah, I went over there, but it was really late. It was like 10:45 at night, and I did check the door, but she never answered. So he volunteered a lot of information to us about his whereabouts, and we got his call records. He actually kept that call that he received on his cell phone and showed us, so we could verify all that. Mark Durbin, we looked at him for a long time, and I had him in the hot seat for probably the better part of a year. There were some other aspects of Mark that were a little bit questionable, but he was always very cooperative. We actually gave us consent to search every part of his building, his living space, his car, the dumpsters. He never scoffed at that. He even volunteered to provide DNA and everything we ever asked him, prints. So he didn't act the part, and he was always cooperative, and we never found any linkage to him other than the fact that he and Ashley had sex that night. And that was a volunteered admission on his part. So, but we still had to look at him for a while. And then I had a lot of conversations with Mr. Ellerin, Ashley's dad. And Ashley's dad had maintained a kind of an email relationship with Mark Durbin. And it was, I think, around May, I want to say May or June of that year that Ashley was killed, that Mark made a statement on an email to Mr. Ellerin that he happened to see this guy, Mike. Still doesn't know where he lives or what his last name is, but he says this guy was bragging to him about cashing in on a big lawsuit against the Trizic Hahn Corporation. Now, Trizic Hahn was building the new hotel. I think it's the Renaissance, and in that area where the Academy Awards are held on Hollywood and Highland there. They were building that at the time. And apparently, as Mike had bragged it up to Mark Durbin, that he was going to score big on this because one of their trucks hit him and injured his back, and he claimed he had a broken back and everything, but Mark said it sounded shaky because the guy's standing up walking around. He looks perfectly healthy. But so I looked into that aspect, and I reached out to that corporation. To their credit, they were very cooperative with me. I spoke with the corporate financial officer, and they turned me over to their legal department, and the legal department looked into it and said, no, nope, we have had no incidents whatsoever matching that description. So there is no lawsuit pending against any of our subcontractors. So that was a dead end. And some reason I got a brainstorm to, well, why don't I just check that whole probably like a 10 or 12 block area square for any type of, traffic related incidents. And I got a couple, but there was one that stood out, and it was a guy walking a dog, and the dog stepped out into the street on Franklin Avenue at Orchid. And apparently a car came by, didn't hit the dog, but came close, and there was an incident. And so a report was made because the young lady that was driving was scared to death. So she called the police, and they did make a traffic-related report. And the name of the dog walker was Michael T. Gargiulo, Michael Thomas Gargiulo. And he lived on Orchid. So just a block down from the accident. And that location where he lived at the time was only two short blocks from Ashley's house. And some of the buildings, if you get on the rooftop like of that building, you could look and see Ashley's house. So it was that's how I first came up with who this guy was. And I was able to get his DMV photo and put it in a photo lineup. And I went to all the witnesses, and they picked him out right away. They said, yeah, that's Mike the furnace guy. Well, that's how we came to find him. But unfortunately, by the time we were able to identify him, he had already been evicted from that location. He wasn't there. So my partner and I had gone back there, and they said, yeah, he's long gone. But at least we knew who he was. And we got more focused on that.
Mike would talk about his career as an actor, or that he was a professional boxer training for the Olympics. And interestingly, he also told stories about what brought him to LA from Chicago. He would tell some of Ashley's friends about being wanted by Chicago investigators, who were waiting to collect DNA samples from him because his best friend's girlfriend had been murdered. Tom, what else did you find out about Gargiulo's background once you had a name?
Well, the way things evolved, we were on the hunt now and trying to figure out where this guy is, because what we learned is he really doesn't, other than that Orchid address, he didn't put really anything in his name. He would sponge off women that he would meet on the internet. And, you know, some of these women, you know, they weren't the most attractive women, but they were women that would do things for him, because he would stroke them, and he would do things that made them feel really important. So they did things in return for him. In other words, they allowed him to drive their vehicles, or they had an apartment that he would basically be living in, but it was in somebody else's name. So he was a hard guy to kind of track down. But there were other incidents where Gargiulo attacked other people, made threats to other people. There was a young gal that he had an interest in. And one day, they had a kind of a relationship that began when he worked at the Rainbow Room in on the Sunset Strip, and they knew each other from that work location years earlier, and he bumped into this gal at a grocery store sometime later. And so they were kind of seeing each other, not on a dating relationship, but just he'd show up as a friend and watch a TV show or something, and he'd leave. But then one day, he came in, he was dressed all in dark clothing. He had a real dark look on it, and in his face, his demeanor was weird. And all of a sudden, he starts talking about he was being wanted by the FBI. His best friend's sister was killed in Chicago, and they're looking for him. And then he produces a stun gun with his left hand out of his jacket pocket, and he stun guns this young gal, and he puts a couple of burns on her. And there was a report made, but he split, and nothing was ever done on that case. That was the same year that Ashley was killed, but just later in the year. So, and there was other incidents similar to that. Threatened attacks. He actually threatened a Department of Transportation lady that had impounded his truck. He was going to kill her because his truck was impounded and he was pissed. So that's the kind of guy he is. He's very volatile. 6'2", 195 pounds at the time. He fancied himself to be a boxer. He's in good shape, very strong, hot-headed. So he's had a long history of being a jerk. So that's Mike Gargiulo.
As Detective Small dug more into Gargiulo's background, detectives in Cook County, Illinois were finally making progress on the physical evidence in Tricia Picaccio's murder. The DNA test results detected DNA from two people on Tricia's fingernail clippings. One was Tricia, and the other, an unidentified person. Detective Lou Sala from the Cook County Sheriff's Cold Case Division tracked down more than 20 witnesses in Tricia's case, collecting DNA samples from each to look for a match. By fall 2002, only one name remained: Michael Gargiulo. In our next episode, detectives try to track down Michael Gargiulo. We learn more about his background, and the DNA evidence in Tricia Picaccio's murder comes under question. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Hollywood Ripper.